Good evening. We begin tonight with five words that define where we are in the pandemic. Acknowledge the war has changed. Those words come from a slide presentation produced within the CDC, which we learned about overnight. The war has changed because the enemy has. The Delta variant, according to the CDC presentation, travels as easily as chickenpox, meaning each person can infect on average as many as nine other people. Additionally, today, the agency released the study it based its new recommendation on to wear a mask indoors, even if you've been vaccinated. And it showed that infections with the Delta variant produce similar viral loads, regardless of vaccination status. In other words, even the vaccinated, who likely won't be anywhere near as sick, thank goodness, can still spread Delta. The war has changed. Late today, President Biden acknowledged that additional measures might be coming because of it.
In all probability, by the way, we had a good day yesterday. Almost 1 million people got vaccinated. So I'm hopeful that people are beginning to realize how essential it is.
The president today signaling some tougher tactics against this tougher adversary. The CDC study was based on a large outbreak in the Massachusetts vacation spot Provincetown at the tip of Cape Cod. Ken Horgan owns a hotel there.
We started to get the initial reports of some strange infection rates among vaccinated individuals. And then as time went on, we saw more and more cases until we eventually saw a number that was large enough to make a lot of us kind of scratch our head and say, wait a minute, is this something?
And it was. But because the vast number of people in Provincetown are vaccinated, few people have gotten seriously ill. That's the good news. But later in the hour, we'll speak with a doctor who was vaccinated, visited Provincetown, and caught a breakthrough infection she believes from other vaccinated people there. The war has changed. And almost exclusively among the unvaccinated, the casualties are growing. Here's a public health official in St. Louis reacting to the CDC news.
I was filled with dread last week about this. And as I looked at this report and our local stats earlier today, I'm even more worried now. ICU admissions have doubled in the last couple of weeks here in the St. Louis region. The community transmission levels are at an all-time high.
In red or even more vaccine hesitant parts of the state, it's not just how many cases that's troubling doctors, it's also the type of patients they're seeing.
We had about 15 patients hospitalized with COVID in the middle of May. And we're at about 150 in Springfield in our hospital. So, you know, it's up 10 times. The patients we're seeing are sicker, they're younger, and they seem to be getting sicker faster.
And the war has changed in that respect, too, but not, thank goodness, in this. According to this new internal CDC document, vaccines, even with Delta, make you 3 times less likely to get infected and 10 times less likely to get severely ill or die. Let me just say that again. Vaccines make you 3 times less likely to get infected and 10 times less likely to get severely ill or die. They work. Of the people in Massachusetts in this latest CDC study we mentioned, no one died and only 5 were hospitalized. So getting a shot is still a great way to stay healthy and stay alive. Additionally, new CDC data out today shows that 90% of adverse events in adolescents to the vaccine are non-serious. Now, with all this in mind, more states, even some red states, have amped up calls for people to get the vaccine. Georgia, for example, which is not even 39% vaccinated, according to CDC data. State officials there saying hospitalizations have risen 50% in the last 2 weeks and deaths by 18%. More companies requiring employees to be vaccinated. Disney and Walmart becoming the latest today. In addition, Walmart employees will once again be told to mask up regardless of vaccination status. And of course, there's the president late today opening the door to new federal measures. That said, not everyone's getting on board. Even with the threat to the unvaccinated becoming clearer than ever today, Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis issued an executive order blocking mask mandates in schools, blocking mask mandates that would protect unvaccinated students against a virus that's exploding in his state. The governor saying there will be no lockdown, school closures, restrictions, or mandates in his state. The war might have changed today, but some on the battlefield have not. Here to talk about it and take your questions are Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. He's also author of the aptly titled Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. Also joining us, Michael Osterholm, director of the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Dr. Hotez, so Admiral Brett Giroir, the former assistant health secretary under the previous administration, warns that the Delta variant is so contagious that if you've not been vaccinated and you did not previously have COVID, you will become infected. What does that mean for children under the age of 12 who are ineligible to be vaccinated?
Well, it really depends on where those kids are, especially as schools open. And the big vulnerability that I'm sounding the alarm about is the what's going on here in the South. For instance, the state of Louisiana, you've got where Delta, the variant is accelerating now, and kids are already starting to show up in pediatric intensive care units. You've only got 17% of the adolescents vaccinated, 15, 16, 17% of the adolescents vaccinated, maybe 30 to 40% of young adults. You've got the Delta variant accelerating and no mask mandates. So this is a crucible. And as schools open, so in, for instance, in some parishes in Louisiana, you're probably looking at August 9th or 10th when schools open. This is not going to go well. I think we're going to see this big, steep acceleration. So as bad as things are right now in the South, they're about to get worse if for lots of unvaccinated individuals. And this is why, you know, we're working overtime to try to convince people it's still not too late to get vaccinated before schools open, but time's run out and you've got to do it now.
Professor Ostrom, I mean, tonight Dr. Fauci is calling this, quote, a different and more formidable virus. How do you think this war will change now that we know vaccinated people infected with the Delta variant can transmit the virus?
Well, things will change a bit, but I think, Anderson, the one thing we have to remember tonight, if no one takes away any other message than this, that these vaccines still are highly effective in reducing severe illness and hospitalizations and most infections. Please understand that. So no matter what else we discuss tonight, that's an important issue. I think the challenge we have right now is with this increased infectivity is what does that mean? If you look at our previous surges of infection, the cases have risen very rapidly in different parts of the country over the last 18 months and then dropped rapidly. And we don't understand exactly why. I think it's very possible that we're going to see this surge take off in the southern states as it is now. Whether it'll spread to the other states in a meaningful way, I don't know. But I think it's possible that by September, we'll see that this thing will just drop again, just as it's done in a number of other locations around the world. We can't count on that, but I think that's likely what will happen.
And Professor Ostrom, I mean, I think it's really important to stress what you said, which is vaccines work, and vaccines are, frankly, for everybody, it's the only way out of this. I mean, we don't have to be in this situation.
Exactly right. You know, and I think one of the challenges we have is when these surges end, when these big bursts in cases suddenly come down, people that come on the other side of it that haven't been infected say, oh, well, I missed it. I'm not going to get it. I made it through. You know, you can't run out the clock on this one. Eventually, as was in your lead, this virus will find you. It is that infectious. So if it's not this surge, it'll be the next surge. And I think that that's an important message, is that don't try to run out the clock. It won't happen. You will know a COVID-related outcome. Please get vaccinated.
Dr. Hotez, we've got a lot of viewer questions I want to get to. Marcy asks, everyone talks about the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. What about those of us that took the J&J shot? Do we need a booster? What's our level of protection? We received a lot of questions about the J&J vaccine. Doctor, people are worried. Should they be?
That's one of my most frequently asked questions. And the answer is we do not have clinical data against the Delta variant, or at least not that's been publicly made available. We have laboratory data showing that people who have virus neutralizing antibodies to the single dose J&J vaccine have some virus neutralizing antibodies against the Delta variant, but it's way down compared to the earlier lineages like the UK variant. And when I look at the numbers, and they're small numbers, you know, one has about a dozen serum from a dozen patients, another eight or nine patients, or those who've gotten the vaccine, the decline looks similar to the decline that we saw with the South African variant, and we know that translates to a decline in efficacy. So I don't want to extrapolate too much, but I do think a single dose will have some decline, and that means we got to really hear from the CDC and FDA very soon about a second immunization of the J&J vaccine or move to the mRNA vaccinations, and I hope we get some word out very soon.
By the way, Dr. Otis, right now, I mean, somebody who's got the one J&J vaccine, if they want to just get a booster shot, if they want to get another shot, can they just go somewhere and do it?
Well, it's not always the case. It depends on your healthcare provider, and some will not authorize it. And sometimes the pharmacist will say, look, if you look at your vaccination card, I can't give you another dose. So it really varies. And this is one of the problems that CDC really and FDA really have to come out with recommendations pretty soon. Also for the third immunization for the mRNA vaccines for vulnerable populations, those on immunosuppressive therapy, transplant patients, et cetera, and also some of the older individuals, because this is what they're doing now in Israel.
Professor Ostrom, as we heard President Biden said tonight, in all probability, there will be new COVID restrictions. Our viewer Beth is wondering about that, too. She asks, what's the risk of outdoor transmission for fully vaccinated? Should there be large outdoor gatherings at this point? What about that?
Well, we've learned clearly over the past 18 months that this virus is transmitted by what we call an aerosol. These are this kind of mist-like transmission in the air. If you want to understand what an aerosol is, just think of somebody smoking. If you can smell the smoke from their cigarette, that's the very same as if you were breathing in the air that they exhale out that has the virus in it.
Wow.
So we do have examples of where we do have transmission in outdoor activities where people are close together for an extended period of time. But clearly, indoor air is by far the biggest challenge. As you and I both know, if I were in a room right now with you smoking, you would smell it and smell it very quickly. And so that's what people have to understand. If you can smell a cigarette in the location you're at, then you're breathing someone else's air that may have the virus in it.
That's really stunning to say it in that way. I actually hadn't heard it said that way, and it makes it quite alarming. Professor Osterholm, along those same lines, Stanley writes, with the Delta variant and greater viral load, is 6 feet still the recommended distance? He's, of course, talking about social distancing.
Yeah, well, 6 feet is, to my mind, already outdated. When we came up with this understanding of the aerosol transmission of this virus, we've realized that it could be much further. How many times have you been 20 feet downwind from somebody smoking and smelled that smoke?
Yeah.
And so 6 feet works in the old respiratory droplet idea, where if I am talking or coughing, it's like boulders coming out of my respiratory tract, out my mouth, and then falling to the ground. That's not the case here. So if you're indoors, and again, just rule of thumb, or if you're outdoors, you can smell the smoke. You can also inhale the virus.
Wow. Dr. Peter Hotez, Professor Michael Osterholm, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Next, new notes taken by the third man in a phone conversation between the former president and the acting attorney general. And as you'll see, they literally spell out his intention to lie about the election and his demand of America's top law enforcement official to help him do it. We'll speak to the lawmaker who brought this new evidence to light. And later, the major new decision that could finally deliver the former president's tax returns to congressional investigators. This next story falls squarely into the shock but not surprise category. And if you're still lacking evidence after three troubling new accounts of his final days that the former president was consumed with staying in office and never mind democracy, this one is for you. It's perhaps the closest we might ever get to a signed Oval Office photo of him with the inscription, "Here I am on the phone trying to overturn the election." Now, we've already seen reporting that he was constantly calling Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen, hectoring him for evidence of voter fraud, something the previous Attorney General William Barr had already said simply did not exist. Today, the House Oversight Committee released handwritten notes by Mr. Rosen's deputy of a December phone call that he and his boss had with the former president. Here's the key portion. The handwriting isn't especially legible, and it might not come across on your TV screen, but quoting the former president, it reads, "Just say that the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the R congressman," Republican congressman. In other words, just lie, and other liars, myself included, will take it from there. We're joined now by House Oversight Committee Chair Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney. Chairwoman Maloney, this is, I mean, it's another example of the former president going to the most extreme lengths to overturn the election in his final days in the White House, but to have it handwritten by somebody, the deputy or the assistant to the guy who he's talking to, what happens now? I mean, what's your committee going to do about this? Or can they do?
Well, just as you said, it's highly unusual to get any documentation involving direct comments of the president of the United States, especially to get handwritten ones documenting in great detail that he was urging the Department of Justice to call the election, quote, illegal and corrupt, and implied and threatened them that they would be replaced if they didn't comply. And when DOJ pushed back and said this is not true, there was no signs of any corruption or illegal activity, he said, just leave it to me. just go out and say it, and Republican congressmen and we'll do the rest. It's shocking beyond belief. We are in the midst of an investigation. We did not have these documents that you're revealing tonight until early yesterday morning, and more are coming in. And we're not going to stop until we get to the bottom of this. Those who aided or witnessed Trump's unlawful actions must answer these committee questions about the attempted subversion of our democracy. It is extremely serious, and we are not stopping until we get to the bottom of it.
Well, also for the president to say to the acting attorney general, you know, just leave it to me and the other and, you know, the Republican congressman. He knows he has a stable of Republican Congress people who will propagate that lie. And he's right about that. Many are still propagating that lie. But he was so confident in not only his own ability to lie, but also that he would have a whole host of actors willing to go along with it in Congress.
Well, all those that are involved should be called forward for questioning. We have gotten clearance from DOJ to question six leaders in the Department of Justice. We are arranging those interviews for next week. We expect them to fully comply. If not, we will figure out how to force them to comply, and we will continue with our investigation.
At another point during the call, the former president described Congressman Jim Jordan as, quote, a fighter. And I want to play something that Jordan said recently to Spectrum News about his conversations with the president on January 6th.
Did you speak with President Trump on January 6th?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke with the president last week. I speak with the president all the time. I spoke with him on January 6th. I mean, I talk with President Trump all the time, and that's I don't think that's unusual.
On January 6th, did you speak with him before, during, or after the Capitol was attacked?
I'd have to go. I spoke with him that day after. I think after. I don't know if I spoke with him in the morning or not. I just don't know. I'd have to go back and. I don't know when those conversations happened. But what I know is I spoke with him all the time.
I mean, first of all, kind of remarkable on the day the democracy is attacked by our fellow citizens, and he spoke to the president. He's just now talking about that. It's the second time in recent days that Jordan has been shaky about his conversations with the former president on January 6th. You might think he would remember talking to the president of the United States on the day that the Capitol is being attacked. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not surprised at all that he said that he talks to the president all the time, that he talked to him on January 6th. And we need for him to recall what these conversations were and put forward any information he has of any efforts by former President Trump to overturn the election, to pressure leaders at DOJ to call it an illegal and corrupt election when it wasn't. It's shocking. The allegations, actually the proof that we're seeing is unprecedented.
Chairwoman Maloney, I appreciate your time. Thank you. Joining us now, senior political commentator David Axelrod. David, I mean, what do you make of this? I mean, again, I'm just shocked to actually see a handwritten note by somebody listening in on the phone call, taking notes while the president is saying this. Just say the election was corrupt. Leave the rest to me and the R congressman.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it is appalling. Nothing is shocking, Anderson, anymore, because, you know, there's a well-established storyline here and a well-established pattern. He does not believe, he never believed in rules or laws or norms or democratic institutions. And it was very clear that he was trying to overturn the election in any way he could. We've already heard the conversations he had with state officials, local officials, in Georgia, asking them to find the votes that he needed. He's obviously given amplification to crazy conspiracy theories that have one after another been thrown out in courts of law. I mean, this was, you know, his idea was, I'm going to take this however I can. What's outrageous is that there were elected officials who were so willing to cooperate with him. And that is appalling. But We should note that they're also, including these two officials of the Department of Justice, the acting attorney general and his deputy, who are unwilling to do that. There were people at the state and local level who are unwilling to be cowed and bullied by the president of the United States. And our democracy was saved by that margin. The last thing that I'd say about this is, after all of this, he remains the, you know, putative front runner for the nomination in the next election. And that is really deeply concerning. We had an impeachment, Anderson, and the argument that was made by some of the president's support, or at least some Republicans in Congress, was, well, he's left already, so it's irrelevant. Part of that proceeding was going to be followed by a motion to disqualify him for running from office again. If this doesn't warrant disqualification from holding public office, and particularly the presidency, I don't know what does.
Yeah, but there, I mean, this is not going to have any impact, obviously, on, you know, Trump's hold on the Republican Party. But just to be clear, I mean, presidents aren't supposed to tell the attorney general, well, just say this and I'll deal with the rest. I mean, they're supposed to be, isn't there some...
Listen, we went through a national trauma in the 70s that I remember. When Richard Nixon tried to use the Justice Department to protect himself from prosecution in the Watergate scandal, and what happened after that were a series of steps by President Ford, Edward Leavy, who was appointed Attorney General, to restore faith in the Justice Department, to restore faith in the rule of law, and those norms have held. For decades and decades, they were absolutely shredded by Donald Trump. We have never seen anything like this, certainly in my lifetime, I think in our history. It was just wanton disregard for the norms of democracy.
Yeah, I mean, history is going to look back on this, and it's not going to be pretty. David Axelrod, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Next up, what the Justice Department decided today about the tax returns of the former president that congressional investigators have long hoped to access. That's coming up when we come back. The Justice Department today advised that the Treasury Department must, in its words, turn over the former president's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee, which has waged a two-year battle to gain access to them. In an opinion by the Department's Office of Legal Counsel, Justice said that the committee chairman has invoked what it termed sufficient reasons for requesting the returns. The Trump administration refused the committee's original request and triggered the ongoing battle. I want to get some legal perspective now from CNN senior legal analyst Ellie Honig, former federal prosecutor and author of Hatchet Man, How Bill Barr Broke the Prosecutor's Code and Corrupted the Justice Department. And from reporter and author Tim O'Brien, who's actually had a chance to see some of those returns as a result of a lawsuit filed by the former president questioning the accuracy of his book, Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald. So, Tim, as we just mentioned, you've actually seen the former president's tax returns. You can't discuss what you've seen. What do you make of today's announcement by the Department of Justice?
Well, there's a lot of elements in it that I think are important that go beyond Trump himself. I think it establishes that the Congress has a supervisory role to play with the executive branch, particularly around whether or not the president has financial conflicts of interest that can compromise how he or she might conduct their affairs while in office. I think it also put a very firm check on a previous Department of Justice ruling in 2019 under Barr that I think essentially tried to establish the idea that the Congress was only on a fishing expedition and had no fish supervisory role to play, which I think was in keeping with Barr's, I think, traditional view that the executive branch should be more independent from oversight and congressional oversight. But I think the real, to me, Anderson, what I think is a seminal development here potentially is they are putting into print the fact that in the modern era, a president like Trump or any president who comes into that office with the kind of financial conflicts of interest that Trump has needs to be supervised more closely because it can corrupt or compromise policymaking. Right. And I think that goes beyond Trump. It's a new element that Trump introduced when he became president, and it's good to see that being put in play as something to check.
Ellie, I mean, legally speaking, does this mean that the fight for Congress to see the former president's taxes is over and that they'll get his returns?
Just about, Anderson. This means it's highly likely Congress will get those returns. Here's how we got here. So the law says that if the House, the Ways and Means Committee, requests the tax returns of any person, the Department of Treasury, the IRS, shall furnish. That's what the law says, shall furnish those returns. Now, the Trump administration, as Tim said, Bill Barr came up with this convoluted legal theory that, well, that doesn't really apply, even though it says shall. So we are not turning over anything unless the courts force us. Today, the Biden DOJ reversed that. They said, well, shall furnish means shall furnish. So we are going to turn it over unless the courts stop us. So now the ball's in Trump's court. Either if he does nothing, then those tax returns are going to Congress, or he can try to file a lawsuit to try to stop this. But he's looking at a serious uphill climb there legally.
But that could take a long time, couldn't it? I mean, why wouldn't he just try to tie this up in the courts?
Yeah, that could be the strategy, Anderson. Exactly. Although I think, given his history, I think it's likely he does try.
Yeah. Tim, you were saying given his history?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Ellie. I'm sorry. I think in there, they basically have given him a 72-hour window to try to come back at this. So they clearly have said, we're opening a door if you want to contest it, but that door is not going to stay open very long.
Tim, the Justice Department also cited the former president's tax returns could reveal what they said were, quote, hidden business entanglements raising tax law and other issues, including conflicts of interest affecting proper execution of the former president's responsibilities. I mean, do you see this as potentially revealing liabilities, not only for the former president, but for others in Trump orbit?
Certainly. I mean, it would go a long way towards explaining why Donald Trump engaged in these corrupt and unseemly diplomatic dances with Vladimir Putin and other dictators. I think, the easy explanation at the time, I think, and it was a real one and had merit, was that he had a juvenile fascination with authoritarian leaders and he liked to preen around them. But I also think always in the back of Donald Trump's mind is, how quickly can I make a buck? And I think that a very direct reason he was doing a lot of these things was in order to feather his own nest financially. And one of the unfortunate elements of a Mueller investigation is that Robert Mueller chose not to probe deeply into Trump's finances, which remains a mystery to me. And I think it's important that those things get unearthed, again, not only in terms of Trump, but in terms of any president who has financial conflicts of interest that need to be scrutinized. But it also certainly would go a long way towards explaining what motivated a lot of Trump's actions.
And Ellie, if the returns go to Congress, is it possible the public would see them?
Yeah, I think it is, and potentially fairly quickly. We know the Manhattan District Attorney has had these returns for almost a year now. We're not going to see those. Those are grand jury materials. They have to remain secret. We won't see them unless and until there's an indictment and a trial, which, who knows, that's very far off and unlikely at this point. However, Congress doesn't have those same limitations, but Congress should think about this, because the position they've taken is, we want those tax returns not to just embarrass the president, not to just put them out there, but because we need them to consider specific legislation that we're thinking about. So they may want to think about the political impact of putting those tax returns out, but there's really very little to prevent it.
Ellie Honig, I appreciate it. Tim O'Brien as well. Thank you. Straight ahead, I'll talk with a well-known pediatrician who is vaccinated against the coronavirus, still diagnosed with the disease after visiting Provincetown, Massachusetts on holiday at the center of a cluster of COVID cases earlier this month that the CDC has been studying. That's next. We told you at the top of the program about that COVID outbreak in the small resort town of Provincetown, Massachusetts, with hundreds and hundreds of new cases reported. One of those infected, Dr. Jane Aronson, is a pediatrician and a specialist in global infectious diseases. She's also a friend. She joins me now. Jane, thanks for being with us. First of all, how are you feeling? You said you were very frightened by your symptoms after you first came down with COVID.
Yeah, I'm better. I mean, I feel lucky, and every day it's funny to be in a way looking at my illness and realizing that every day you can see yourself getting better. And that's a powerful message that I want to give people.
You feel lucky because you were vaccinated.
Oh, my God. I still remember the miracle of going up to Cornell, where I'm on faculty, and getting my first vaccine and then my booster. And I just can't tell you how proud I was.
If you hadn't been vaccinated, what do you think would have happened with this infection?
I was dreading. I was for sure feeling as if I could get sick at any point. And I really worked hard to keep myself safe. And I was a vigilante with friends and family about how to stay safe.
But once, I mean, if you hadn't been vaccinated and you got the Delta variant in Provincetown, I mean, you at your age, which is probably close to my age, you would, I mean, you're at risk.
Oh, I have to tell you that there was no question that I was already very convinced that I couldn't get Delta. I just felt like, you know, I was counting the months and asking at, you know, at the various places I could ask, like, does anyone know what my immunity is really about after 6 months? And I'm turning 70 in the fall. And all I could think of was every day I was eking out whatever antibody I might have had. And I wanted to talk to someone about getting another shot.
Do you know how you got it? Because there's a lot of people who have gone to Provincetown this summer who have ended up infected, and a lot of them were vaccinated. They're not hospitalized, thankfully, because they were vaccinated. So it's not a commentary on the vaccines themselves. It's a commentary on how easy it is to catch Delta. Do you know how you caught it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that the two possibilities was that I loved that Dune tour. I used to go on it myself, but I wanted to go on the Dune tour.
What is that? Driving in a car on dunes?
Yeah, it's okay. up those famous, beautiful dunes in Provincetown.
So you were sitting near people in a vehicle?
Well, I was in a vehicle with another friend, and there was plastic across and just the driver. Huh. And we were there 15 minutes on the way up, and then we were outside on the dunes, and then we were 15 minutes back. Hmm. So that was really what, and I called. And I found out that, yeah, that the driver was infected and then had been vaccinated. Hmm. And then the other was a breakfast where we were not set in our usual place for breakfast, where we were like separated with guards on either side. Suddenly they removed it. But we said, okay, we'll just have our breakfast. And we had breakfast with two really lovely guys and chatted. And maybe we were exposed over maybe a 20 to 30.
And what is your, I mean, people who are seeing this are maybe saying, wait a minute, you're an infectious disease specialist. You caught this. You've been vaccinated. Why should I get vaccinated if it doesn't make any difference?
Okay, well, it does make a difference because I'll tell you what happened. I mean, I developed symptoms within a couple of days, and my shortness of breath was so frightening. I don't even know how to express it. It reminded me of patients I've taken care of who were dreadfully ill and had pneumonia or cancer, children, adults. And I know what it felt like for them when they were short of breath. And I was short of breath and I was frightened. And I had a horrible headache and I had low grade fever and achy muscles and had a dry cough and I was exhausted. And I spent maybe 3 to 4 days like that. Hmm. So I was really aware of what this could look like. And I was absolutely frightened. And I had to be, you know, sort of calm down. Like people, were really helping me.
Do you think the vaccine saved your life?
Right. And that's exactly what happened. I felt immediately like I'm scared, but I know this vaccine will work. And I want to tell people. I feel so open-hearted. I've always counseled people on not getting vaccinated, kids. And I felt like, let me talk to people. I'll love them into taking it. I'm good like that. I can convince anybody to do anything. I wanted a chance already months ago, and now I want the chance here to say, don't be afraid. Open yourself up to an opportunity to be well and safe. And for us all to work together as a community. I'm sorry to be so preachy, but I just feel like we're all together on this. And I want to tell people about that. Hmm. I'm better and I want them to know they can talk to me. I'd be happy to talk to anybody so they could take the vaccine.
Dr. Jane Aronson, I'm glad you are okay. And I'm thankful that you agreed to tell your story. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anderson.
Just ahead, how Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is trying to make sure no school system can mandate masks despite a big rise in cases and hospitalizations in his state. As we mentioned earlier in the broadcast, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has issued an executive order meant to fight the CDC guidance for mask mandates in schools. It orders the state to issue emergency rule to prevent any school system in Florida from implementing an order. The one in Broward County, the second largest in the state, voted this week to do just that. Governor DeSantis says this was done, quote, to protect parents' freedom to choose whether their children wear masks. Now, this comes as new COVID cases in Florida have jumped 50% in the last week, and as hospitalizations have reached the same level they were at in early August, almost 1 year ago. Joined now by Dr. Aileen Marty, an infectious disease expert at Florida International University. Dr. Marty, thanks for being with us. A 50% jump in cases in Florida is pretty sobering. With these kind of numbers, as a doctor, what do you think about Governor DeSantis blocking or issuing an order to block mask mandates in schools?
Well, let me just be very clear. The situation is grave and getting more and more so day by day. Our hospitals are jam-packed, and people are in long lines waiting for to be seen, and including children. And this is absolutely tragic. So the situation is bad. This order is based on a study that was done up at Brown, and it's a small study that contradicts every other study, including CDC studies, in the state of Florida. And that study is not peer-reviewed back in May, and it probably will not even be approved. So it's very surprising, because the reality is every leader right now should be doing their absolute best to reduce the transmission of this horrific virus.
So, I mean, we're learning just how transmissible this Delta variant is. They say now, the CDC says, as transmissible as chickenpox, as in each person can give it, I think it was, to nine other people. As we get close to the opening of schools in Florida, do we know enough about the impact of Delta on children who can't get vaccinated? I mean, what do you expect to happen once kids are back in the classroom unmasked, if they are, assuming their parents don't want them to be masked?
So I'm hoping that parents are going to do what is best for their child and for their community and ask their children to use masks, because the reality is, as I already mentioned, we are seeing very young people, including young children, coming into hospital symptomatic with COVID here in the state of Florida. And what we don't need is to have long-term complications in these children. So it's like going against medical advice. I mean, you're going against the science. I can certainly release you from hospital against medical advice, but that's what it is. It's not following the science, and it's not following the best medicine.
So just to be clear, you would say, vaccinated or not, every child, teacher, and staff in school should be wearing a mask?
That's the recommendation of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I wholeheartedly support that recommendation. It's also the recommendation of the Infectious Disease Society of America and virtually every medical society in the United States right now.
Governor DeSantis spoke earlier today. I just want to play a little bit of what he said.
I have young kids. My wife and I are not going to do the mask with the kids. We never have. I want to see my kids smiling. I want them having fun.
Do we know the possible long-term effects of a child who gets COVID at this point, who gets the Delta variant? I mean, are kids susceptible to, you said you're seeing them in the hospitals. Are they also susceptible to long COVID?
Yes, the children are susceptible to long COVID, although we don't actually have all the data of what that incidence is going to be or for how long they're going to have any kinds of complications. The biggest risk for children is the multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or Kawasaki type syndrome, that we also see in some young adults. And even that is very uncommon. But if it happens to your child, it's absolutely tragic.
Yeah. Dr. Aileen Marty, appreciate it. Thank you very much. Just had something a little lighter, but also a serious question. Just what was that on the president's chin? And did he really? Well, you'll see. We wanted to end on something a little lighter that could either maybe make you, some people thought it was funny, others thought it was just kind of gross. But today, President Biden was meeting virtually with Western governors about the wildfires in their states. And while listening to the conversation, a staffer handed him a note. He takes it, he reads it. Now, later, he was holding the note in a way that the cameras could capture the text, and what it said was, "Sir, there is something on your chin." So that happens sometimes. It's certainly, you know, and it's always that awkward thing of like, do you tell the person there's something on your face? If it's me, I always prefer to be told that, you know, there's something hanging off my chin or whatever. Anyway, let's look at the video again. So he's handed the note. He reads it. Sir, there's something on your chin. And he wipes it, looks at it. I don't know if he, did he eat it? It looked like he, I mean, I can't confirm it, but it looks like he did the old kind of, I don't know. Leave it up to you to decide. Like I said, something to make you smile or maybe cringe a little bit. I cringe. The news continues. Let's hand things over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.